This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Welcome to the best of Definitely Not the Opera. I'm Sukyun Lee. Now, some highbrow art connoisseurs out there dismiss pop culture as a trite and disposable commodity. Well, here at DNTO, we are committed to exploring its deeper significance in our lives. So this week on the Best of DNTO, we're looking at how pop culture can actually change your life and sometimes even save it. How's that for mortal consequence? Coming your way, amazing but true pop culture testimonials from Canuck cartoonist Chester Brown, wrestling superstar Chris Jericho, and the author Elise Friedman. And what better way to begin the convo than with pop culture enthusiast and super comedy man, Sean Cullen. Hello, Sean.
Hello. How are you?
Thank you for coming in on such a wintry afternoon.
It's very wintry. I almost didn't make it. I was almost frozen.
Well, out of every bit of cultural ephemera out there, Sean, what is the one thing that changed your life?
Now, I hope this is ephemeral enough, but when I was a little kid, when I first started watching, comedy had a huge influence on me, and when I first saw the Monty Pythons, I think. And I say, is that pop culture? Is that a pop culture thing?
Oh, yes.
I think so. Because it's the kind of thing that, you know, at school, everybody would be quoting it to each other. And you'd learn all of the argument sketch. Or, you know, that wasn't an argument. Yes, it was. No, it wasn't. You go on and on and do these things. And that, for me, the idea that these really, as you get older, you realize, and as I watched it later in life, they're just so unbelievably intelligent and clever, and the way it was all deconstructive, but at the time it just looked so silly. And these guys were somehow making a living and respected and loved and all of that for doing something absolutely ridiculous, like slapping each other with a fish, dressing up as women, and talking in a high-pitched voice, not even trying to be good actors, act like women. They were just, oh! And I thought that was the most brilliant thing. The Monty Pythons had kind of tuned my mind for absurdity.
Wow, I could imagine young Sean Cullen's mind being blown.
Well, I was, I was willing to be mind blown at the time. I don't know. It was just such a, I grew up Catholic. And the world, it's a very serious world, but also very absurd in its own way. You know, saints and, this, the weird kind of feast days of people, or Saint Blaise, who's the saint of throat ailments and stuff like that, and it's all quite serious. But I think that the Monty Pythons, they pointed up how absurd just normal things can be and blown out of proportion. And it made me look at everything that I was around me at that time and go, that's really weird and that's silly. So I'd sit there with my dad. I remember my brother and I, my dad would watch it, and he would just get sick of it. He said, this is ridiculous. This is stupid. This damn stuff. Why do kids watch this crap? And I'm like, well, I don't know. It's just so funny.
Were you just the budding comedian back then, or was there something about seeing people do ridiculous things that unleashed your own inner ridiculosity?
Well, I guess that's what it was. I mean, it did really kind of bring out this urge to perform and to be silly for people. And I guess that it could be that started it. But I don't remember clearly if it started before that or, that was, but that was a huge part of, motivating me to do comedy.
Neat. Thank you, Sean. And hey, peeps, if you want to blow your party favor at your radio, count down the new year with Sean on CBC Radio 1 this year. That's right, Sean Cullen's annual New Year's Eve extravaganza from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on the Mother Core. Head to cbc.ca to listen live if you don't happen to be near a radio at midnight. Over now to Winnipeg R&B singer Flo, who says her pop cultural turning point came courtesy of Lauryn Hill in a little movie called Sister Act 2.
All you need to do is hear Lauryn Hill's voice for the first time, and you're just captivated and taken away and inspired. And just seeing another young black female with a voice like that going out there and singing just really inspired me to do the same. And the funny thing, in our high school choir, we used to just sing classical songs or traditional songs. And one girl who also did a little bit of soul asked if we can do songs from the Sister Act 2 movie. And I thought to myself, I have to do this. You know, the other songs, I always had yearned to do solos and go out there and do it. But after seeing that movie and seeing that they're going to do souls from that, I'm like, I can do this. I can do that. I'm going to do this. So that was the first opportunity I had to do solos and go right in the middle of the stage, and fell in love with it. So I'm going to be playing a song off my album. It's called Tired. It's got more of a jazzy, acoustic R&B feel to it, which is why I love it. It makes me think of people like Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, but yet hits Jill Scott and India Re type feel. Andrew Wasson is going to be the guitarist who is kind enough to accompany me. So we'll be playing Tired from the album Flow.
Tired by Winnipeg soul diva Flo, performing in the DNTO studio. Check out her MySpace page, myspace.com/flowsoulmusic. This is the Best of DNTO, where this week we're looking at the life-changing power of pop culture. And joining me now is a guy who's all over TV these days, actor Carlo Rota. Carlo stars in the hit CBC TV series Little Mosque on the Prairie, and you might recognize him from 24 and La Femme Nikita. Hello, Carlo.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. And yourself?
I'm extraordinarily well, thank you. It's a
wonderful,
lovely day down here in Los Angeles.
You little bum. It's
yes,
freezing here.
I know, but you have to realize that some of us have had to sell parts or the whole part of their souls in order to exist here. So,
yeah,
you know.
That's true. It's a high price to pay.
Carlo, it is.
Time to spill the beans. Okay.
Yes.
What is the one pop culture confection that has changed your life?
Well, you know, I always think that the biggest life-changing event that happened to me was when I made a rather abrupt transition from being, you know, a maitre d' restaurateur to being an actor, and that occurred when I was 30. And if I can spill the beans of my age, it would basically happen in 1991. I moved into a apartment on Soho Street, just off Queen Street in Toronto. And at the time, I guess looking back, I allowed myself, because I went from earning money and having a job to being an absolute wastrel, having no job, I allowed myself a beautiful time of indulgence. And I read voraciously because I didn't have a TV set and I didn't want a TV set. And I read authors in their entirety. But I think that if I was to, you know, zero in on an author that really got me going, for some reason or other, it's going to sound strange, but I remember Somerset Maugham and his book of Human Bondage was the book that stands out for me at that time for some odd reason.
Of Human Bondage. Why? I mean, what blew your mind about that particular book?
Well, the book dealt with, you know, the protagonist was a fellow who had essentially the desire to become an artist, and the hardships that he faced and the people that he met. And also his love interests, I felt, were very much part of my existence at the time.
So do you think his release of bondage into an artful world, did that sort of set the course for your own career?
Well, I think that the book mostly speaks, the title mostly speaks to the bondage that we all unwittingly suffer from, and that no matter what transpires in our lives, is very difficult to get away from. And in his case, it was a disastrous attachment to a woman that didn't care anything for him.
How did the tale of, you know, trying to break free inspire you?
Well, at the time I was, I owned a couple of restaurants and, you know, I had a career. I was, you know, I was an upstanding citizen of sorts, I guess. It just came to an end one day. I couldn't do it anymore. And I didn't know really what my path should be. The only thing I knew was that I had a desire. What I was good at in the restaurant business was that I had a great empathy with people. And for some reason or other, it made sense at the time to me, because I think of my state of mind being not, you know, like wholly right to pursue acting, because I felt that empathy was a big part of acting. Little did I know that in Los Angeles it would prove that empathy actually here doesn't matter whatsoever.
It's a hindrance.
It totally is a hindrance, yeah.
Just kidding. Well, that's pretty cool. So you changed it all around.
I really changed it around. It was like a
big change. Thanks to Somerset
Maugham. Well, Somerset Maugham and a couple of other influences.
Carlo, have you revisited Of Human Bondage since then?
I have it. I bring it around, like it travels with me. It's in my apartment here in Los Angeles, and I haven't opened it. I haven't cracked its spine since then. I feel that I shouldn't. It's like it's a museum piece.
It sounds like a talisman. Wear it around your neck.
Well, it's a little big, but sure. I mean, sure. I mean, you can do that here. That kind of size bling is acceptable.
Thanks, Carlo.
Thank you.
That is Carlo Rota. Look for him on Little Mosque on the Prairie, which airs Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock on Ye Old CBC TV. Let me tell you, they are lining up around the block to proclaim the life-changing powers of pop culture. Up next, Canuck cartoonist Chester Brown, the author of the best-selling book Louis Riel, a comic strip biography. Now, Chester credits one particular cultural artifact with forcing him to reevaluate his worldview. Here's his story.
I began my adult life as, you know, a typical Canadian NDP-type leftist. I despised right-wingers and you know, they were against gay rights and they were trying to push their Christian moral agenda on other people and that sort of thing. But as time went on, I began to see that leftists were also pretty much doing the same thing. They were trying to censor people and push their politically correct type agenda on people. So I began to grow disillusioned with both ends of the political spectrum, and I ended up as an anarchist. I was against any type of government. Organization should come from as small a community as possible, preferably from the individuals themselves. So at around that time, I decided to do this book about Louis Riel, a graphic novel. And because of my anarchist views, I wanted to make government look as bad as possible. And if anyone reads that book, the Canadian Prime Minister in there, Sir John A. Macdonald, does come off pretty bad. When I was in the early stages of creating that book, I realized that Riel's story focuses a lot on the issue of property rights. The Métis believed that they were in danger of losing the land that they lived on. So I figured I should read a book about property rights. And it was at that time that this book, The Noblest Triumph, Property and Prosperity Through the Ages, by a guy named Tom Bethel, came out. Bethel's view was that property rights, it's the fundamental right that guarantees all our other rights. And that property rights also have brought the West tremendous prosperity. And that's why you see so much poverty in third world countries, is because they don't guarantee them in the same way. There is much about the right to own your own body, therefore the right to free speech because you own your vocal cords or whatever. They're fundamental to all sorts of rights in the West we take for granted. And Bethel won me over. I became convinced that he was right. The thing is, property rights do have to be enforced, and for that you need some form of government. So the book turned me around politically. Because I was coming from this anarchistic point of view, that government should be limited as much as possible, kept as small as possible. And I knew enough about politics to realize that that would make me a libertarian. I had a problem with that, though, because libertarians are widely perceived, you know, as being right-wingers. And I had this tremendous bias against right-wingers. I was like, I don't want to become that. That's the last thing I want to become. But the logic of, specifically, the arguments of this book, The Noblest Triumph, forced me to accept that I was becoming a right-wing jerk. Compared to the people who surround me, I find myself taking the right-wing position most of the time.
And how does that go over with your friends?
Not well. I find myself getting into arguments all the time. Because I'm an artist, most of my artsy friends are all leftists. At least it makes for interesting conversations. I'll give it that.
So then, how has Tom Bethel's book, The Noblest Triumph, changed your life?
I've joined the Libertarian Party, and they've asked me to run in the next election, so I'm considering doing that. And in my work has now become more focused on stories about individual liberty.
That is budding politician and Toronto-based cartoonist Chester Brown. Check out Chester's book, Louis Riel, a comic strip biography published by Drawn and Quarterly. It's in the works to become a live-action movie directed by Bruce MacDonald. Now, over to actor and writer Trish Cooper. Her life was changed. No, wait a minute. Actually, make that scarred by a little TV show called Let's Go.
If you were a Canadian child in the 80s, you may remember a show on Saturday mornings called Let's Go. The host was a bubbly Janice Dunning, and every episode had five or six kids singing songs and making up skits with the help of some cheap costumes and some big blocks. Be anything you want. You can be a moonbeam or a star. So come on, let's go. There is somebody just like you. We're gonna make believe. We're gonna be pretending to. When I was 9, I auditioned for Let's Go. It was so exciting. We had to make up skits and sing a song, and we had to each tell a little family story. They laughed at my babysitter skit, and they were all so nice. Janice Dunning said I was great. I didn't get picked because I was too young. But it was a small group trying out, and I already felt really special just to audition. The next year, they held open auditions. My music teacher, with her big mouth, made a big announcement. She gave the class this big song and dance about the extravagant lives the kids on Let's Go live. My sister was on Let's Go, so I knew better. I mean, it's a good gig for a kid, but Ms. Howard filled their heads with stories of fame and fortune. Paul Serafimoff bought a boat and a cottage. Diana Sorelli bought a car and helped her single mother pay off her house. I remember looking around and seeing all these big-eyed kids imagining how they would spend their money. They were all in it just for the cash. Ross McKernan, as if. He couldn't even stand to read aloud in class. But they all came out in droves, and so must have every other kid in Winnipeg. It was a circus of brats and show-offs. Very unprofessional. They told us they only needed 2 girls and 5 boys. Typical, even then. After the 4th round, they brought me and this girl, Amanda, and 5 boys into a room with the musical director, Victor Davies. He played the piano, and we sang, and the producer sat down and asked us whether our parents would drive us to practice and how we did in school. I almost felt bad for all those other kids. I could tell Amanda and I were going to be good friends. Yeah. I didn't get on Let's Go. But every other stupid kid in the neighborhood did. I'm serious. It wasn't 2 girls and 5 boys. It was like 1 million kids. Justin Soshicki, please. That kid could barely talk. Margaret Walker, she had no imagination. I was devastated. It still makes me crazy because if I had actually gotten on Let's Go as a child, I wouldn't still be pursuing this stupid, ridiculous life as an actor. If I had just gotten it out of my system when I was 10, I might be a happy, well-adjusted teacher right now with RSPs and sick days. I shouldn't be trying to still write skits and play with blocks in my 30s. Screw you, Let's Go. We're gonna make believe. We're gonna be pretending to. For Let's Go, I'm Trish Cooper. I mean, for DNTO, I'm Trish Cooper.
Oh, Trish, you know what? I think it's time for you to let go of the whole Let's Go experience. Just let it go.
My name is Elise Friedman. I'm the author of a book called Long Story Short. And pop culture changed my life, maybe even saved my life back in 1980. I was 16 years old and not in a very good state of mind. I was suffering from agoraphobia, which meant that every time I tried to leave the house, I would get dizzy and my heart would go squirrely and I would feel like I was going to die. So I decided that I would just stay home forever. I had dropped out of school and I'd spent about 6 weeks in my room smoking cigarettes out the window, listening to Blood on the Tracks and reading Catcher in the Rye over and over again. There were 3 things in the world that made sense to me: nicotine, J.D. Salinger, and Bob Dylan. Now, I don't know how I heard about it, but I found out that Dylan was going to be playing a 4-night gig at Massey Hall, and I really, really wanted to go. So, essentially, I forced myself out of the house. Now, the first night, I made it as far as the Finch subway station before I got perilously ill and had to turn around and head home. On the second night, I tried again, and I got down to Massey Hall, and I bought a ticket from a scalper and got as far as the lobby before I had to head home again. And on the third night, I finally made it into the concert, and it was amazing. It was the gospel tour, which isn't my favorite Dylan, but he was growly good, and the backup singers were awesome. And I went again on the 4th night, and after that, my agoraphobia was completely cured. So pop culture, by way of Bob Dylan, changed my life, possibly even saved it.
You know, I am a big fan of legendary wrestler, The Missing Link. He's the caveman wrestler who was so gonzo, he stopped speaking for 10 years straight. The Missing Link communicated through a chalkboard he wore around his neck. He was so out of control, which was a big part of why I liked him. One night, I went to see the missing link wrestle at a bar in my neighborhood. I wanted to meet him in person, so I flexed my media muscle and set up an interview. To my shock and disbelief, when I entered the changing room, I found the missing link talking amicably with his arch nemesis, El Diablo. Wait a minute. Those guys aren't supposed to be getting along. And what were they doing sharing the same changing room? And the missing link was talking. It was at that moment in my life I realized how incredibly gullible I am and always will be. Now, over to another wrestler. And this one's got a lot to say. Chris Jericho, a.k.a. Y2J, is one of the biggest stars of World Wrestling Entertainment. The Winnipeg Grays wrestler was named the first ever undisputed champion of the WWE and racked up a whole slew of titles along the way. Chris recently returned to the WWE after a two-year absence, but he was a busy guy during his time off. In October, he released his memoirs called A Lion's Tale, Around the World in Spandex. And we've got the spandex-wearing Y2J himself on the line to talk about his pivotal pop culture moment. Hello, Chris.
Hi, I'm wearing spandex right now, actually. Very supple, form-fitting, colorful. It makes me feel like a superhero at all times.
Hey, Chris, before you started out wrestling, who were some of your wrestling heroes?
I always loved, for me, it was always about wrestling and rock and roll. I was a big fan of, the real charismatic guys in wrestling and the real charismatic guys in rock and roll, like David Lee Roth and Paul Stanley, guys like that. So I always liked the guys that were kind of a combination of both.
Yeah, you're a rocker, too. You front a band called Fozzy.
Absolutely, yes. We have three records out, and we do actually do really good over in the UK. Those wacky English, just loving the Foz, crazy teeth and all.
Whoa, I mean, is it as physical as wrestling? Are you doing the whip with your head and wearing spandex when you're with Fozzy?
Not wearing spandex so much, but still whipping the head back and forth a little bit. But I think the fact that you don't actually have to get thrown on your head when you're rocking makes the rock and roll a little bit easier when you're on stage.
Yeah.
So, heavy metal definitely healthier than pro wrestling.
Okay, so before I ask you about your life-changing pop culture moment, let's play a round of rapid-fire pop culture questions in 60 seconds or less.
Got it.
Are you with me, Chris?
I'm ready.
Okay. Say the first thing that comes to your mind. What was the first concert you ever went to?
The Police with the Thompson Twins in 1983.
Wow, very cool. Did you gel up your hair, new wave style?
No, I was just happy to be there. Although, if technically, the first concert I ever saw was the Thompson Twins because they came on before the Police. So I was screwed from then on. Doctor, doctor, and Josie, I'm free. However it goes.
Right. They were kind of like
my heart.
Sexually ambiguous.
They were. They had a girl in the band that looked like a guy. There was a black guy. There was a red-haired guy. They said all the racial stereotypes.
They plucked their eyebrows, no eyebrows.
And the ultimate je ne sais quoi, the fact that they had three of them, yet they still had the audacity to call themselves twins. Ah, the humanity.
Okay, who would win in a cage match? Brian Mulroney or Conrad Black?
Brian Mulroney, because he's got that jaw. He's got the jaw of a fighter. Plus, if worse comes to worst, Ben Mulroney can swoop in and save the day.
That's true. Hey, which Winnipegger would you rather see in spandex? Burton Cummings or Neil Young?
Oh, that's obvious. Cummings. This is the mustache. Enough said.
Okay, what high school clique did you belong to?
I was in a strange clique. I was in a clique that could hang out with everybody, hang out with the burnouts, hang out with the jocks, and everyone in between. We were kind of the rock and roll creative guys that everyone wanted to hang out with because we always had cool ideas and were doing fun stuff and interesting stuff. Yeah, I was actually pretty lucky. I don't really know. Kind of escaped the whole high school clique era because I was friends with everybody.
Did you have to pound some heads back then in high school?
No, I was too short back then. I was just a little guy.
Wow, that must have been pretty cool, eh? Like, from a little guy to a growth spurt, and then whammo, you're like, big guy.
Yeah, then I went back and beat the crap out of everybody who used to laugh at me. Bastards. But it was cool when I went back for my 10-year high school reunion, and I walked back in there, and they were all like, I think I won like best ass or something. They had a contest and I won best ass. So there you go. 10 years of working very hard to go back to my high school reunion and win best ass, which was second only to winning Manitoba's sexiest man, with the second runner-up being Burton Cummings.
Oh,
you're not sexier than Burton Cummings. Time to just pack it in.
Hey, Chris, if they made your book into a movie, who besides you would you want to play you?
The fat kid from Superbad. That kid rules.
Nicely done, Chris.
Thank you.
Okay, my final question to you is, what is the one piece of pop culture that really changed your life?
Huh, that's a good question. Obviously, when I first saw Star Wars, see, it was interesting. Back like in 1977 when Star Wars came out, like all there was G.I. Joe dolls, like one or two of those. But Star Wars is the first movie that had just a multitude of tie-in toys and merchandise. So I think that's why all the kids from my generation are so Star Wars obsessed, even after all these years. Even when you watch Star Wars back, I mean, it's great, but it's a little bit cheesy. The acting is pretty bad. But I think the reason why it sticks so much is because there was just so much product thrown at us that you just couldn't help but to become a Star Wars. I mean, it's like one of those things, if they feed like a baby small increments of crack, he grows up to be a crackhead, and you can't figure out, you know, like, why? Same thing with Star Wars. They fed us so much Star Wars, so much product placement, so much merchandising, that for the rest of our lives, all we'll ever think about is Star Wars. It was genius, and I still buy Star Wars toys to this day.
I can't imagine.
Right then and there is the defining cultural moment, was seeing all the Star Wars merch that was out there.
You drank the Kool-Aid, Chris.
I did. I drank the Kool-Aid. It was good. Wookiee flavor.
It was black.
It was. It was black. Black as night. As black as Darth Vader's cape.
Chris, thank you so much, hey?
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, you take care of yourself.
All right, you too. Bye.
Bye. That is Chris Irvin, a.k.a. Chris Jericho, a.k.a. Y2J. Check him out on WWE's Raw, wrestling fans. And also look for Chris's autobiography. It's called A Lion's Tale Around the World in Spandex, and it's in bookstores now. I am Sukyun Lee, and you are listening to the best of DNTO, the Pop Culture Changed My Life edition. Now, okay, imagine if somebody told you that all those hours that you spent watching America's Next Top Model or playing Guitar Hero or headbanging to Motley Crue actually makes you smarter. Well, that's the intriguing argument made by Steven Johnson, author of the best-selling book, Everything Bad is Good for You, How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. We caught up with Steven on the phone in Brooklyn. Hello, Steven.
Hello.
Okay, Steven, you're one of the very first people to study how pop culture is actually good for the brain. So in a nutshell, what's your proof?
I know you guys are talking about kind of breakthrough kind of moments. But in a way, for me, the thing that started this whole project was this experience I had about 5 or 6 years ago playing the video game SimCity with my nephew, who at the time was about 7 years old. And, you know, SimCity is one of the most popular games of all time. And in the game, you know, you manage a city on the screen, and you get to solve all these problems, and you build highways and zone for commerce and residential buildings, and you build power plants and so on. And so I was showing it, 5 years ago to this 7-year-old nephew of mine, Wyatt, and at a certain point I showed him this industrial area that was all run down and I couldn't seem to get going, and he turned to me and he said, you know, I think you need to lower your industrial tax rates. And, you know, it was one of those amazing moments where you realized he was thinking on this very high level in this game, thinking about urban planning, thinking about development, thinking about the relationships between taxation and industrial development. And he was 7, right?
Wow.
And so I thought, if this is what the kids are doing, you know, for fun, why aren't people talking about this? This is so different from, you know, when I was 7, I was playing Pac-Man. You know, I was playing Pong. And so there's been this really kind of tremendous change in the complexity of these kind of passive or interactive entertainments.
So you're kind of coming at it from like almost a neurological perspective, looking at reaction and physicality of what is demanded by the player of these video games.
Exactly. I mean, you know, another example from television, and from brain science as well. One of the things we know about the human brain is that it's very good at mapping social networks, right? It's very good at keeping track of, you know, complex networks of people. You know, think about your office social network, the people who are getting along, who's getting along with the boss, who's not getting along with the boss, you know, who's flirting with whom, who's not getting along with whom, who's feuding. So the question is, you know, what happens if you look at the history, say, of television shows in terms of the social networks that you have to map in your head to make sense of what's going on? Have those gotten more complex? And in fact, they have dramatically gotten more complex. If you go back and look at a show like Dallas from 1978, which is, you know, the hottest show on TV, and actually, you know, had a lot of characters in it because it was kind of a soap opera. If you compare it to any number of shows that are on television today, I mean, everything from, you know, 24 to Lost to The Sopranos, and you know, all the way up to shows like The Wire, which are insanely complex, there are something like three or four times as many characters and relationships between those characters that you have to keep track of in any given episode. So things that were literally, you know, if you'd put them on the air in 1977, people would have said, I cannot follow this plot. There are way too many characters. It's just too complicated for me to see. We now are actually able to follow, and these are, you know, big, huge, internationally successful shows that have made a lot of money for their creators. So something has changed in the kind of popular mind that's helped us kind of be able to make those social networks at that level of complexity actually, you know, entertaining and fun for us.
Why do you think so many people dismiss pop culture as fluffy and trite?
You know, it's the same thing that happened with rock and roll, right? I mean, we went through this. Every generation thinks that the pop culture of its kids is garbage. I mean, it happened in 1967 with this crazy new music and the long hairs who were listening to this noise, and now it's happening with, you know, Facebook and kids playing Halo and you know, watching reality shows. There's always this assumption that the teenagers are up to no good, but actually, if you look at what the teenagers are up to right now, they're up to a lot of good. And in fact, this generation, the generation that has grown up on the internet, the generations that's kind of graduating from high school and college right now, in the U.S. at least, is simultaneously the least violent generation in 40 years, and it's the most entrepreneurial generation in 40 years. So you have this really extraordinary combination of people who are, you know, not at all violent in the way that we would think, given all the kind of controversy about violence. And you have this amazing kind of drive to go out and start companies and get involved and be innovative in your 20s that just wasn't there before. So, you know, when people talk about the impact of this culture and, you know, the dangers of it, I look out there and I say, you know, I don't see any evidence for us to be concerned.
Another one of those things that people toss around of phrases is the dumbing down of culture. I mean, what do you think the future of pop culture holds with regards to this, what you see as this sort of evolutionary path of people?
I think that's an interesting question for schools and what we teach in schools. It may be that there's a lot of problem-solving skills and a lot of technological skills that kids are actually just getting from the pop culture, and then it's going to get even more and more intense as they deal with more complex forms of computing technologies at a younger age. But we may want to be teaching those social skills more and more because they're getting that less from their screens than they used to from kind of face-to-face life.
Hmm. Well, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us, Stephen.
My pleasure.
That's Stephen Johnson. He's the author of Everything Bad is Good for You, How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter. And that's it for this week, peeps. Be sure to download us next week when we revisit some of our favorite stories of the year. And don't forget to check us out on the good old radio. Visit cbc.ca/DNTO to find out when we're on. Our show is brought to you by pop cultural anthropologists Doug Holmes, Sarah Tate, Josh Schmidt, and Anna Lazowski. Iris Uday is our executive producer. I'm Sukhyun Lee. Talk to you next week.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.